Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Any Given Lifetime by Lita Blake. Narrated by John Solo. Prologue. January 2012. Atlanta, Georgia.
He doesn't look like it, Joe,
Alice said, staring at her squalling son, whose face scrunched in fury and pale skin grew blotchy from crying. She pushed her still damp hair behind her ear and tried to get more comfortable on the hospital bed.
That was my brother's name, Jim said stubbornly.
He reached out and touched the baby's clenched fist, which seemed to set off another round of wails. He jerked his meaty hand away, and his dark caterpillar brows stitched together ominously. The muscles of his chest rippled as he crossed his arms. Alice tried to place the baby to her breast, shushing and soothing him, hoping that the nurses wouldn't come into the room and try to talk her into feeding him formula again. Her milk would come in just fine. She knew it would, if he would just latch on, for heaven's sake.
I promised my mom I'd name my son after my brother,
her new husband pressed on. His gray eyes took on the flinty look that she had already learned to fear. Alice refrained from mentioning that the baby wasn't actually his son. Both of them were very bent on pretending otherwise. It was best for everyone if Marshall's memory was left with his body, blown to bits in the desert of Afghanistan. Jim had married her out of an obligation to his dead best friend and claimed Marshall's son as his own, determined to raise him right. Alice was grateful for his help, even if she didn't have his love or want it. Alice had tried to care for the man, but it was hard to love a man as unpredictable as Jim, especially after having been loved by someone as tender and thoughtful as Marshall.
Did you hear me, Alice? I promised my mom, Jim said again.
Afghanistan hadn't been kind to Jim, taking both his brother and his best friend.
Yeah, I know you promised,
Alice agreed, looking down at her son's face as he mouthed at her nipple, never quite taking it in before he started screaming again.
But look at him. He's just not a Joe.
You got a better name in mind?
Jim asked, his voice implying that whatever she suggested, it better be good, or else.
Neil, she said, whispering the name that had rung through her like a bell the moment she took the baby into her arms. Neil Joseph, she added quickly, for your brother.
Jim chewed his bottom lip, but then he nodded once, and Alice relaxed, relieved that was the end of it for now. She smiled up at her husband, and he smiled back, tense and insecure, but good enough. At least there wouldn't be a row. For his part, Neil screamed even louder.
January 2012. Scottsville, Kentucky.
Joshua stood by the creek of his family's land in his hometown of Scottsville, Kentucky. He shoved his gloved hands into his coat pockets and studied the winter gray sky reflecting in the ripples of the dark water. All around him, the woods creaked and rustled. A squirrel chomped on a nut, eyeing Joshua suspiciously. The creek was deep and wide, bubbling over rocks and fallen limbs carelessly. When he was a boy, he'd played in it every day, digging on its banks, jumping in up to his hips, skipping over the rocks from muddy shore to muddy shore. It had been his favorite place on earth. He still loved it, but it had been over a month since he'd come out to the creek. Not because he had forgotten about any of it, but because he was making an active attempt to hurt less. Somehow, he'd convinced himself that if he avoided the place where he'd carefully emptied the container of ashes, all that had been left of Neil after the cremation, maybe he wouldn't feel cut to the quick. Avoidance hadn't worked, though. So, here he was. Hey, Neil, he said, rocking on his heels. I miss you. The creek burbled and rushed.
Like life itself, it was nonstop and joyful in its lack of empathy. On it went, sluicing over gravelly bottoms and slipping through woods and fields. Onward, never a glance back, just forward into forever. My new baby brother was born today. Remember how I told you my mom was pregnant? He arrived. They named him Sam. He was quiet for a second, trying to feel Neil there with him, wanting some kind of connection, but he got nothing at all. "You're really gone, huh?" he asked. The wind blew around him, ruffling his hair, but it didn't feel anything like Neil. "Where'd you go?" he murmured. "Off with the water into the great unknown." It's part of why he'd cast his remains into the creek, wasn't it? To release him, set him free. So why did he keep coming back to the creek, looking for something he'd never find? Joshua listened harder. "Where does the river take you? Where did you end up?" Then he smirked. I know. I can hear you telling me that you didn't end up anywhere, that you died. And any ideas I have to the contrary are just hopes and wishful thinking. You'd say I'm better off accepting reality and moving on. Joshua ran a hand through his hair and shrugged. The squirrel decided this human wasn't quite sane, talking to himself this way, and skittered into the woods and then up a high tree. "I might be better off, Neil. But I just can't believe that." He stared up at the clouds covering the sky. The water rushed at his feet. "I don't want to believe that." The grief fell on him again, heavy and useless. He made a big show of shaking it off, clapping his hands together and saying, "So, anyway, since we last talked, things have really kind of sucked. Paul is bugging me to sell my Grandpa Rogers' lumber company, come back to Nashville and live with him. He says I need to finish my degree, pick up where I left off when you..." He swallowed hard. "When you died. But I'm not ready." "I'll never be ready. Nashville isn't for me. And Mom and Dad aren't capable of running Stouter Lumber. They never have been. Dad's more into the farm, and Mom's got her career as a teacher. It's on me to keep Grandpa Rogers' legacy alive. Just like it's on me to keep yours alive, too." Joshua sat down on the cold ground and wrapped his arms around his knees. "Why'd you do that, Neil? Put all that responsibility in my hands. I'm only 22 years old. It's too much." Puffing cloudy breath, he squeezed his eyes tight, thinking of all the questions Neil's lawyer still had for him. "How old were you when all that fell into your hands? That's not something we ever discussed." He was silent for a few moments and tried to think of what Neil would say to all of that. He smiled softly when he realized that in all likelihood, whatever Neil said would have pissed him off. "You'd say, 'Suck it up, buttercup.' You'd say, 'Stop taking Paul's calls if he annoys you.' You'd say exactly what I wouldn't want to hear, and I don't think I like your advice any more now than I would if you were alive. But I'm glad that I know what you'd say to me. It makes you feel not so dead. Far away." Joshua swallowed a lump in his throat. That was a lie. Knowing what Neil would say made him feel even more gone. He wiped at his eyes. "I hate you for dying." The wind blew again, chill and full of winter. Joshua bowed his head. "I love you," he said, his breath lifting around him like smoke. June
2012. Atlanta, Georgia.
Alice watched as the doctor examined her son. She could see the intelligence snapping behind his eyes, taking in the world around him in a wordless assessment, and it vaguely distressed her that he seemed to find it lacking.
"He's still nursing?"
the doctor asked, wrapping a measuring tape around Neil's head and then making some notes. Alice nodded. Nursing was finally going well. It had taken a while to get into the groove, but eventually Neil started eating like a champ. When he was wrapped up in her arms, gulping greedily, she felt truly connected to him in a way that she imagined other mothers felt toward their children all the time.
"He's showing excellent advances in motor coordination, and he's meeting and surpassing physical milestones,"
the doctor intoned as though he was bored.
"So he's healthy?"
she asked, a little doubt in her voice. He was, after all, so skinny and moody, and somehow she felt like he was different from other babies.
"Well, he's of lower weight than average for his age, but he's not anywhere near the danger zone on the chart. Given what you've told me in the past about his eating habits, he likely has a fast metabolism. Be prepared for some marathon nursing sessions when he hits his growth spurts."
Alice picked Neil up from the table. His bobblehead jiggled on his skinny neck, and she kissed his cheek. He didn't really relax into her arms, but he didn't fight her either, and she got the sense that he enjoyed being held by her. That meant something, at least.
"Why?"
the doctor asked, seeming to suddenly tune into her hesitations.
"Is there something in particular that you're worried about?"
Alice let out a guilty sigh.
"I just feel, I don't know, like something's missing. My friends, well, their babies are more,"
she winced.
"They seem happier."
A smirk crossed the doctor's face.
"Well, Mrs., he consulted the chart.
"Quinley," Alice offered, still unaccustomed to Jim's name, and wishing she'd kept Marshall's. But Jim would have lost it if she'd even suggested that.
His loyalty to his dead friend didn't go so far as to allow his wife to still moon over him, as he put it.
"Mrs. Quinley, your son may have a taciturn nature, true. Every child is different. But is it possible you might be suffering from postpartum depression? Are you having trouble bonding with him? Do you have an unhealthy burden of guilt or fear that you might harm your son?"
Alice blinked at him. "Guilt? A little. Bonding? She wasn't sure.
She loved Neil and had since the first moment she saw his screaming little face. But he certainly wasn't what she'd been expecting.
Harm him? Absolutely not.
She just wanted to know that he was okay, that he would grow up to be a normal man with a normal life.
She guessed the doctor probably couldn't guarantee her that.
"I don't think so,"
she said softly. The doctor nodded, made a mark in Neil's chart, and said,
"Okay. Well, just let me know if anything changes on that front. I know a very good doctor who specializes in postpartum emotional issues."
Alice gave him a tight-lipped smile and nodded. She cuddled Neil close. He tensed before relaxing in her arms, and then he put his small head on her shoulder, gazing up at her with blue, trusting eyes that pulled at her heart. The doctor left the room, and Alice got Neil's little clothes back on him. She could feel him studying her, so she whispered, "I'll always take care of you."
He waved a fist in her direction, and he almost looked like he might smile, but then he cried instead.
Part 1. Chapter 1. May 2018. Scottsville, Kentucky.
Joshua sat at a tiny table in a quiet corner of Earl G. Dumplin's diner. It was a slow day, and not many other tables were occupied. His coffee was verging on being too cold, and he considered getting up to find the waitress to ask her for a refill, but then he'd have to shift the piles of papers that he'd spread out over his lap, each precariously balanced. There was a stack on the table in front of him that had to do with stouter lumber, all of which he needed to pay close attention to because he was in the middle of converting everything from paper to computer at long last. And his lumber shipping business was often full of rough roads, both literal and metaphorical. He had a lot of responsibility on his shoulders since taking over the family business, and he'd had to learn it all incredibly fast after his Grandpa Roger's death, just a few months after Neil's. Sure, Grandpa Roger had generally reliable people installed when Joshua took over, a lot of them from the local Mennonite sect, but the business itself had spent the last 6 years stuck in the past. Admittedly, that had been appealing to his horse and buggy driving employees, but things had to change if they were going to stay profitable. It was time Joshua got a grip on all the paper his grandpa had used to track everything and converted it to digital programs and processes. That included dealing with tons of old contracts covered in legalese about trucking and transportation, all of which made his brain want to run out of his ears in an effort to escape the boredom. Then there was the stack on his left knee. That had to do with the Neil Russell Foundation for Advanced Nanite Research, including the latest applications for grants and funding. The massive amount of money that had been left behind for Joshua to handle after Neil's death wasn't something he'd ever expected, for several reasons. First and foremost, he hadn't known Neil had changed his will to make Joshua the beneficiary of his estate. They'd only been together as a couple for 9 months when Neil died. They hadn't even made their relationship physical yet, what with Joshua being a skittish country boy stewing in internalized homophobia, and Neil being a very busy research scientist with a healthy commitment to waiting until Joshua was ready. Joshua had known they were in love, believed it with his whole heart, and felt it in his bones. But he had committed the folly of youth. He had also believed they had time. It wasn't until after Neil's death that he'd fully understood, though, just how devoted Neil had been to him. The inheritance had come as quite a shock. Second, Neil had always lived frugally. His apartment in Nashville had been unremarkable, obviously since he'd been Joshua's next-door neighbor, and his clothes had been a uniform of black jeans and black button-up shirts that looked like they could have been purchased at JCPenney or even Walmart. Neil had once told Joshua that his parents, before their deaths, had been upper-crust society types and that he had attended prestigious private schools growing up. But he'd never really spelled out what that meant in numbers. So Joshua had always assumed the money was long gone, used up to pay for Neil's college and PhD, most likely. It wasn't until Neil's estate went through probate that it had become clear just how truly wealthy Neil had been. Nearly $100 million in old family money inherited from his parents, plus Neil's own investments in experimental medical technology that had paid off over the years, had all been left in a trust for medical nanite research after his tragic death, along with strict instructions that Joshua should be in charge of running it and be given quite a hefty salary for doing so. That had been almost as shocking as Neil's death itself. But Joshua took his position as head of the board seriously and personally. In fact, he had been accused of being too involved recently, which made him laugh, because of course he was too involved. The foundation and its funds were all he had left of Neil, weren't they? He'd do whatever it took to make sure Neil's contribution to medical science would never be forgotten. Immediately after Neil and his grandpa's deaths, Joshua had discovered the only way to survive his grief was to work his butt off, and then he had just never stopped. In the stack on his right knee, there were applications for grant money from medical nanite research organizations as far away as Hong Kong and India, and he intended to examine them all thoroughly before meeting with the rest of the board to discuss them the next week. Yet he was being encouraged by certain people to loosen his grip, to hand everything over to someone more qualified, and start moving on. But Joshua had no intention of doing that. Even if Paul, his former roommate and best friend, thought he was losing himself in it all. Paul had thought Joshua was losing himself in Neil when he was alive, too. But if he had truly lost himself in Neil back then, things would have been different between them. Very different. Regret tasted bitter as hell. Taking a sip of his cold coffee and blocking out the ka-ching of the old-fashioned cash register by the door, Joshua shuffled through some of the stouter lumber paperwork on his lap. He barely noticed a stranger who walked into the diner and spoke to Earl behind the counter. It was only when the man came to stand directly by Joshua's table that Joshua looked up.
Mr. Stouter? I'm sorry to interrupt. A man at your lumber company said you'd be here. Do you have a minute?
Joshua looked up into dark brown, soulful eyes beneath a shaggy mane of brown, wavy hair, and couldn't bring himself to say he was busy. After a formal introduction, Joshua insisted on moving to the clean table beside them, one not stacked with papers, so that they could talk on more equal terms. Lee Fargo moved with grace, despite the scarified evidence of former burns. They climbed up over his exposed forearms and under his shirt, then up the right side of his neck, stopping just beneath his chin, as though some kind of mercy had spared his face. Joshua swallowed hard as Lee told his story. It wasn't the first time a donor recipient had sought him out. A woman who'd received one of Neil's kidneys had contacted him by email, and they'd had a long correspondence about the hope afforded to her, especially given anticipated upcoming medical breakthroughs in nanite nephrology. He'd received letters of thanks from a number of people, parents of a few children who'd received some of Neil's skin, a woman who'd had her sight restored with one of Neil's retinas, and a young man who'd received Neil's surviving lung. It was always overwhelming. But this was the first recipient who had sought him out in person, and Joshua didn't know what to say. So he simply listened. Lee had been in a fire while he was in his sister's house. He had been burned on over 60% of his body after going back inside to save his nephew, who was trapped in the upstairs bedroom. His nephew hadn't lived, and Lee had barely made it himself.
"Thank you," Lee said, reaching out and putting his hand over Joshua's fingers, clutching the handle of his coffee cup. "I can only imagine how difficult it was for you to lose your partner. Someone like Dr. Russell must have been really special."
"He was unique, all right," Joshua said, swallowing the sadness and going with a smile.
"Oh, yeah? Tell me about him," Lee said, leaning back again. "I'd love to know more about the man I have to thank for my skin."
Neil's skin. Joshua wanted to reach out and touch, even though he knew that given the rate of cellular overturn, the amount of skin on Lee's body that would have still been Neil's was negligible.
"Well, he was sometimes a jerk," Joshua said honestly. "He was intense, arrogant, and too northern for most of us southern good old boys to handle."
He wrinkled his nose, trying to seem playful, but he knew his grief was showing through.
"Yeah? But you loved him, right?"
Lee's brown eyes were dark and earnest. Joshua couldn't help but think he was handsome, even with the scars marring his neck.
"So he must have had some winning qualities."
"Winning," Joshua said softly.
"Yeah, he liked winning." "Competitive, then?" "Competitive doesn't cover it.
He usually won. Joshua went silent and felt a darkness swell. At everything. And then there was that last time, when he tried to beat the odds for the sake of love, and lost. I'm sorry, Lee said, moving back in his chair. I didn't want to cause you pain. It was selfish to ask too much. I should have thought. He jerked his thumb over his shoulder. I'll just... Joshua reached out and touched Lee's forearm to stop him from getting up. The skin was slick and gnarled under his fingertips. No, please, stay. I'd like to tell you about him, if you still want to hear. Of course I do, Lee replied, and he settled back in his seat. That's why I'm here. Joshua nodded and then waved at a waitress. First, let's get you some coffee. That'd be nice. Thank you.
October 2010, Nashville, Tennessee. The pounding on the door didn't stop. Joshua wrapped the towel around his hips and dashed into the living room of the apartment he shared with Paul. He grabbed Magic by the scruff of her neck and jerked the door open, out of breath and still wet all over. Joshua had noticed before that their neighbor was handsome in an uptight, professorial sort of way. That is, if a skinny, uptight professor with short, dark curls could also be a hot, sexy, all-black-wearing dominant type with a perma-scowl. And given the sharp glare and set jaw Joshua was greeted with when he jerked the door open, this guy was proof positive that a professor could embody both those vibes. His entire body rang with an electric buzz as he stammered a greeting, but the man's grimace and grunt of anger as Magic broke free of Joshua's grip and leapt up against his firm chest quickly wiped away any imagined charm. "Your dog is a nuisance," the man exclaimed, under assault from Magic's eager tongue and paws. On her hind legs, Magic was nearly as tall as he was, which put the man at somewhere close to 5'9", and probably 160 pounds soaking wet, just a few more pounds than Magic herself. Joshua tried to grab at her, but failed to get more than a handful of shedding fur. I'm sorry, just let me... Magic, down! Come on, girl, inside! He lunged, catching hold of his dumb dog, and tried to wrestle her off the man, but in the process, he lost his towel. With cold air on his dangly bits and a writhing, happy dog rubbing all over him, trying to get back to her new friend, he managed to get his apartment door open again and shoved Magic back inside, slamming the door on her. "Nice ass," the guy said, dusting dog hair off his black shirt and jeans. Joshua scrambled to grab the towel from the floor, his wet skin tingling with hot embarrassment. He wrapped the towel around his body and opened his mouth to stammer another apology. Magic barked sharply. Once, twice, three times.
"And that's what I'm talking about," the man snarled. "That bark."
Joshua tied his towel around his waist again, panting and sweating from the effort he had expended trying to get his idiot dog off the neighbor and back through the door. Worse, his damp skin was now covered in short, dark dog hair, so his efforts in the shower were completely undone. He'd probably be late to work now, too. He groaned, humiliation stinging his cheeks, and he raked a hand through his hair. "Sorry, so sorry. About my dog and about my ass."
"The ass was no hardship," the man said. "The dog, though."
Joshua ignored that, wiped a hand over his sweaty upper lip, and went on. "She's just a big puppy. Not even a year old yet. I adopted her last month, and..."
"I know damn well when you adopted her, because that's when my quiet evenings at home turned into a nightmare symphony of dog whines, barks, and outright howls."
The man glared at him so hard Joshua was afraid his already tight-feeling skin might peel off.
Oh, I...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?